Good evening. Early voting enthusiasm sweeps America and New York. School attendance drops, and an anti-nuclear protester is sentenced to 14 months in federal prison. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Monday, October 26, 2020. U.S. stocks tumbled on Monday in thin trade, with the major indices showing the biggest decline in 4 weeks. Prices tumbled amid soaring coronavirus cases and growing uncertainty about a stimulus bill and a dim outlook for an economic recovery. The United States, Russia, and France set daily records for coronavirus infections. The number of hospitalized Americans with COVID-19 jumped to a two-month high. Meanwhile, in Washington, Senate Republicans are set to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, securing Trump's nominee a week before Election Day and a conservative court for years to come. Monday's vote is the closest high court confirmation ever to a presidential election and the first in modern times with no support from the minority party. Vice President Mike Pence's office won't preside at the Senate session unless his tie-breaking vote is needed. Democrats had asked him to stay away after reports his aides tested positive for COVID-19. Trump was expected to celebrate with a swearing-in event at the White House after the late evening vote. Meanwhile, both candidates were in swing state Pennsylvania. Democrat Joe Biden hammered Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who claimed Sunday the U.S. is not going to control the coronavirus pandemic.
He said, and I quote, we're not going to control the pandemic. Washington Post headline today says it's White House gives up on trying to slow virus spread. No caveats, just a deadly admission. Trump called himself a wartime president, fighting the war against an invisible enemy. Well, I've been saying for months, as you well know, that he waved the white flag.
Presidential candidate Joe Biden. In another part of the state, Trump recounted his own brush with COVID, saying the virus doesn't bother him because he's the man of steel.
That's all they talk about, what progress we've made on it, too. We understand it. We know we have to protect our seniors, especially when they have heart, when they have diabetes problems, and we are protecting them. We have the best testing in the world. That's why we show so many cases, because we do more testing than anybody else. But we're doing great, and, excuse me, here I am, right? I'm here too. Yeah. I didn't feel so good one day. One day I didn't feel exactly great, Mike, our great congressman. But I didn't feel exactly great, and I said, what's the story, Doc, sir? You've tested positive. I said, positive for what, Doc? Tell me. But let's make me feel good. And we took something that was, like, incredible, Regeneron. And I don't know, maybe I would have just been perfect just by doing nothing, but who the hell wants to take a chance? And I woke up the next morning and I felt like Superman. Get me back.
For his part, Mark Meadows met with reporters at the White House to walk back his claim about not controlling the pandemic.
The only person waving a white flag along with his white mask is Joe Biden. I mean, when we look at this, we're going to defeat the virus. We're not going to control it. We will try to contain it as best we can. And if you look at full context of what I was talking about, is we need to make sure that we have therapeutics and vaccines. We may need to make sure that when people get sick, that they have the kind of therapies that the President of the United States has, that we can provide those emergency use authorizations. Hopefully will be coming in very short order. And yet at the same time, a national lockdown strategy or a national quarantine strategy that is proposed by the left is not effective, is not what ultimately contain or control this virus.
White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. While the two major party candidates slug it out on the campaign trail, Howie Hawkins of the tiny, environmentally oriented Green Party says Democrats and the GOP are united on one issue, keeping third parties out of the debate.
Well, the debate situation is a case of fraud. The Commission on Presidential Debates sounds like a government agency. In fact, it's a private corporation controlled by the Democrats and Republicans. So they negotiate a contract with each other and hand it to the corporate media and say, this is what we're going to do. And then the corporate media doesn't cover anything but what the two major party candidates talk about. Our platform is probably the most popular platform being offered. Medicare for All, Green New Deal, ending the endless wars, That's what I'm for, and that's what Biden and Trump are against. And that's what the people are for.
COVID seems to be the top issue of the Democrats. How would the Greens handle COVID differently than how the Democrats, than Joe Biden is saying he would?
We would scale up testing, contact tracing, and isolating those exposed or infected so he could go back to work and to school safely. And Trump obviously didn't do that. He's a loser. He's incompetent. COVID won. But Biden hasn't pointed us in that direction clearly. He's had the platform. Instead, he just says Trump didn't do a good job, but he's not telling us what we should be doing.
Biden has said he wants to start a commission to study the courts.
Well, what I would have done before is fight harder. Trump and Attorney General Barr have been trying to undermine the election, calling mail-in ballots fraud, wrecking the post office so the ballots won't get there, even threatening to have Republican state legislatures send Trump electors to the Electoral College even if Biden wins the state. Right there on top of this mile-long rap sheet is grounds for impeaching Trump. And impeachment would take president over hearings for a Supreme Court justice. In the Constitution, it says Congress can limit the scope of jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. We could impose term limits. I mean, the court has become like a super legislative council of lifelong elders, and that's undemocratic. I think going forward, we got to cut back the power of the Supreme Court and get a better balance between legislative and executive branches and the judiciary.
And so what would you like to add, and what you want voters to, when they go into the vote? There's been a lot of early voting. People are obviously really excited about the election to vote out Donald Trump. Where do the Greens stand in that?
We're a second front against Trump. A vote for us is a vote against Trump. And in a state like New York, where Biden has been ahead by over 30 points, the question for progressives is, how are you going to use your vote? You're going to vote for Medicare for All, Green New Deal, ending the endless wars? If you vote for Biden, you're voting against those things, because he's against those things. So use your vote. And particularly in New York, now we need 2% of the vote to keep our ballot line. They tripled the number of votes we need to keep our ballot line. So, you know, progressives should vote, keep a left independent party on the ballot, and tell the politicians what you want.
Have you voted yet?
No, I'm planning to vote at my local polling station on Election Day.
And who are you going to vote for?
I'm going to vote for me and for president.
Hawkins says he's not trying to be a spoiler. He's running hardest in states like New York, where the Democrats have an insurmountable lead. As all eyes are on a looming election fraught with uncertainty, the case of seven peace activists charged with trespassing on a U.S. naval base is drawing to a close as the defendants are being sentenced to federal prison terms. Earlier this month, Judge Lisa Godby Wood sentenced Patrick O'Neill to 14 months in prison for his role in the nonviolent protests on April 4, 2018 at the Kings Bay Naval Base in St. Mary's, Georgia. Two of Patrick's children testified on his behalf as character witnesses, as did his uncle, a retired police officer. O'Neill's 21-year-old son, Timmy, says his dad exemplifies love incarnate, just positive intention toward everyone. When he reports to prison in January, it'll be O'Neill's fourth stint in federal jails, protesting war and nuclear weapons.
My uncle, who's also my godfather and, interestingly enough, a Trump supporter, but also a supporter of the plowshares as a character witness. He's 81 years old and a retired cop from Yonkers. So he was the character witness and basically said a lot of people in the family went to the military. A lot of them were police officers, and Patrick chose pacifism as his road to public service. And that's not a dirty word. And the plowshares were engaged in symbolic activity opposing nuclear weapons, and he was great. And then I had two of my children. I have eight children, and my daughter, my second daughter Bernadette, lives in Atlanta, and she went to divinity school, and she's a Catholic campus minister. She's been arrested with me four times, dating back to when she was 8 years old. She and I and Martin Sheen got arrested at the School of the Americas when she was 10 years old, and she's been arrested with me in the Pentagon, where I've been arrested seven times. And so she was a character witness, and she was very, very good. My son, who's a senior in college down here in Chapel Hill, my attorney, Matt DeLuisio, who also lives in New York, in Manhattan, he said, well, the judge came into court thinking she was going to give you 20 months. After hearing your character witnesses, she went down to 10 months. And then when she heard your father, she went back up to 14. So I got 14 months.
What did you do that got you 14 months in jail?
On the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination, April 4th, 2018, I helped to cut a lock on an exterior gate at Naval Station Kings Bay, the home port for Trident submarines, which, of course, are the most diabolical creations that humans have ever come up with. They're weapons of mass destruction. It's a first strike weapon. The Trident II D5 missiles hit their targets within 100 meters accuracy. No nuclear weapon needs to hit anything that close unless it's a first strike weapon. And it was a very destabilizing weapon when the Tridents were put into service in the mid-80s, late-80s, and very disruptive to the relationship between the Cold War relationship between the United States and the former Soviet Union. And basically, you know, the Trident submarine represents the end of the world. That's the only purpose of it, is to end the human experiment. And so we went on the base to protest that Trident submarine. This Navy base had a shrine to nuclear weapons, honoring nuclear weapons, surrounded by flags and a brick wall with the name of the base and everything on it. And they had about 10 statues of nuclear weapons. I went in there with a hammer that I got from Shane Claiborne. He's an evangelical lefty out of Philadelphia. And it was made by some Quakers out of melted down guns. And I took a few swats at the Trident II D5 statue, which was actually an exact replica of the Trident, a massive missile. It was made of cement, so my hammerhead broke off, and I banged on a few other things, some signs and some other things. I mean, they basically said we were vandals, but when the fact that we got 3 felonies and a misdemeanor and convicted of all of them, I guess they considered us pretty serious vandals.
Any sort of espionage or terrorism type of charges?
Well, conspiracy was a open and shut case. The government always goes after conspiracy whenever they can get it. Well, the 7 of us signed a conspiratorial document indicting the base for being in violation of international law by building these weapons of mass destruction. That was an open and shut case. But I also wore a GoPro camera on my forehead and filmed everything I did. We were charged with conspiracy and depredating government property. To depredate means to lay to waste, to plunder, or to prey upon. We did not get breaking and entering. We just got trespassing, which was a misdemeanor. We were convicted of that. The depredation felony is a 10-year felony. That was a pretty serious one. But if they had given us sabotage or something, we could have faced more serious charges. But sabotage has been overturned by one of the circuit courts now, and U.S. attorneys are not going to apply sabotage to peace protesters anymore.
When you get out, what are you going to do when you get out?
Well, I'm 64 years old now. If I live long enough, I'll do another plowshare action. If my wife, the mother of my 8 children, lets me. She's the one who's going to be paying the price while I'm in prison. We have a Catholic worker house, and she's going to be running it without me.
And that's Patrick Neal, who was sentenced last month or earlier this month to 14 months in prison for his role in a nonviolent protest on April 4th, 2018 at the Kings Bay Naval Base in St. Mary's, Georgia. There are 18 Trident submarines. Each carries 24 nuclear warheads, each warhead big enough to level most cities. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio was crowing today about the massive turnout. Voter turnout over this weekend. Saturday and Sunday were the first early voting days approved by New York to improve social distancing and prevent the polls from becoming a super spreader of COVID-19. De Blasio says nearly 200,000 voters took advantage, but despite the enthusiasm, there were problems with long lines up to 8 blocks long and multi-hour waits to cast a vote.
It has been building up. And that energy exploded in such a positive way this weekend with early voting. We saw people really own their democracy this weekend in New York City. We saw the people come out in numbers we've never seen before to express their views and determine their future. Almost 200,000 New Yorkers voted in early voting on Saturday and Sunday. Unbelievable. Literally, we've seen nothing like it before. Now, look, this is something all New Yorkers should be proud of. People care so deeply. And early voting's just begun. You already see that many people engage. That's something beautiful. There's more time ahead for early voting and, of course, Election Day. And, of course, absentee ballots as well. So this is a great sign that people may be getting involved in a in an unbelievably powerful manner. This could be great for our future as well. But right now, we've got a problem. The Board of Elections was clearly not prepared for this kind of turnout and needs to make adjustments immediately to be able to support all the New Yorkers who want to take part in the democratic process. We need this to be a better experience. You know, long lines tell people to go home. That's just the reality. Long lines at a poll site discourage voting. They don't encourage it. And we've worked so hard over these last years to make voting and make the democratic process better, to make it more accessible, to make it clearer. We cannot, at this crucial moment, see people discouraged. So here's what I'm calling on the Board of Elections to do. Right away, the Board of Elections must increase the number of voting machines and must ensure the staff is available at early voting sites to help people vote quickly and efficiently and help them move on with their day and not be discouraged from voting. The Board of Elections needs to step up. This is a historic moment. They need to act like it's a historic moment. Let me be clear from the beginning. There are plenty of election machines, voting machines that are on hold for Election Day. Those machines should be brought out now and put in the early voting sites so that New Yorkers can vote more easily. The hours right now, the weekend hours for early voting, are only 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. this coming weekend. Those hours should be expanded. The solutions are staring us right in the face. So I'm saying to the Board of Elections, let's make these changes immediately for the hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers who are ready to vote in the days to come through early voting.
De Blasio says the problem plaguing voting places could be fixed if professionals ran the election.
I don't think there's a conspiracy at the Board of Elections. I think there's incompetence at the Board of Elections, and I think the Board of Elections is just the wrong organization the way they're structured. It should be abolished. It should be replaced by either a city agency or a state agency, a professional modern agency that runs the elections like we would run any other city service.
The mayor added the days of New York's political bosses running elections to their own benefit are over.
The Board of Elections is a vestige of a corrupt past. It just doesn't make sense. It's a vestige of Tammany Hall. How on earth is the election system run by party officials instead of nonpartisan public employees? This just doesn't make any sense. So what I would happily team up with the governor on is legislation to abolish the board as it's constituted now and come up with an entirely different agency. We could do that for next year's elections.
Families currently signed up for the remote-only option in New York City public schools will now have only one more opportunity to transition to a mix of remote and in-person learning during the academic year. Mayor de Blasio, joined by City Schools Chancellor Richard Carranza, announced Monday families could enroll in the so-called blended option beginning on November 2nd through November 15th. Meanwhile, some New York City students who've missed too many remote classes because of faulty devices and unreliable internet are being threatened with having child services notified. Education department officials say they've scrambled to clarify to schools they cannot report suspected educational neglect to the city's Administration for Children's Services without first confirming that the virtual absences aren't related to tech shortages. Schools Chancellor Richard Carranza addressed the issue.
Should be no reporting to ACS of any student that's having difficulty with technology. What should be reported is to the school that they're having difficulty with the technology, and it's our job to follow up and make sure they get the right form of technology. That being said, it's also important to understand that as we look at attendance, it's important for folks to reach out to families where we haven't seen students logged on or we haven't seen a positive history of being online or checking in with us, because we want to know, are those students safe? But we have sent out guidance last spring. We've also updated that guidance this semester, making it very clear that technology issues should not be one of the reasons for a report to ACS.
And the mayor echoed the message, adding it's time to get Wi-Fi into homeless shelters where thousands of students live.
The instruction I have given to the law department and to social services is to ensure that every shelter gets Wi-Fi, to send teams out to literally go shelter by shelter and simply ensure that not just for that student, but for the whole shelter, Wi-Fi is in place. We've got to stop this and make sure everyone has what they need.
And that's Mayor de Blasio. And in another local story, District Attorney Darcell D. Clark announced today that 136 guns, mostly revolvers and semi-automatic pistols, were turned in at the Bronx gun buyback held on Saturday at St. Luke's Episcopal Church. 74 participants received an iPad, courtesy of the Bronx DA's office and the New York Yankees, as well as a cash card. District Attorney Darcell Clark said, "I'm pleased that there are 136 less firearms in homes or on the streets. This event was an opportunity for people to turn in guns, no questions asked, and receive cash and a useful tool to help their children's education." Clark spoke last week with WBAI about the gun buyback.
"The reason they want to turn it in, we want it turned in because that's a gun that somebody who may be mentally ill or going through some kind of depression or whatever, guns lead to suicide. We have accidental shootings with children. We have guns that are stolen from homes and used illegally against others, either in shootings or robberies, etc. So any gun, illegal gun or gun that we can get out of the home and safely destroy is just one less opportunity for somebody to use it illegally or for somebody to be hurt or harmed or killed."
"Has there really been an increase in the use of firearms because of, you know, the COVID, the economic situation, the political situation? Has that actually contributed, do you think, into an increase of the use of firearms in the Bronx?"
"We have twice as many, almost three times as many shootings than we had last year. The number of homicides that we have in the Bronx have already surpassed the number that we had all of last year. So I think it's a perfect storm. It's COVID. It's unemployment, it's homelessness, it's a number of things, it's gang violence, it's retaliations, it's all kinds of things that are happening in our communities that's adding to the shootings and the violence that we see.
People are on edge more."
"That's an understatement."
And that is the District Attorney of the Bronx, Darcell Clark. The Legal Aid Society and the New York Civil Liberties Union are suing Mayor de Blasio and several top NYPD leaders, accusing them of coordinating a de facto policy of indiscriminate police violence against large-scale protests this summer. The federal civil rights action concerns 11 plaintiffs who were allegedly beaten by NYPD officers during the wave of protests in late May and June following the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The complaint alleges de Blasio and the NYPD brass encouraged the NYPD's brutal month-long crackdown, which violated the First and Fourth Amendment rights of protesters. The mayor said the suit is uncalled for.
"From what I've heard of the lawsuit's allegation, it doesn't sound right at all to me. You know, there's been a conscious effort for 7 years now to change the relationship between the NYPD and communities, with a neighborhood policing strategy, with de-escalation training, with implicit bias training. We've seen a fundamental change. Many, many fewer arrests, many fewer gun discharges, much less incarceration. This has been going on for 7 years. So clearly what we want and what we believe in is a better and more peaceful relationship between the NYPD and the community. I think that evidence is clear."
In June, 300 Bronx protesters were arrested in an operation called Kettling. They were cornered and police using pepper spray moved in to make arrests before the curfew at 8 p.m. Human Rights Watch issued a thick report accusing the NYPD of violating the protesters' rights. But Bronx District Attorney Darcell Clark says peaceful protest is something she supports, and her office has dropped all the charges against the protesters.
"One, because they were only peacefully protesting, they should not be criminal ramifications for that. And two, that's 300 people that would have to come to the courthouse during COVID where we are trying to keep people safe. So I made that application before the court, that motion, and it was granted. So 312 summonses were dismissed, and those people were not prosecuted."
Bronx District Attorney Darcell Clark. And finally, Chief Leader reporter and WBAI regular Bob Hennelly spoke with WBAI about the effect of undoing the protections of Obamacare, what that effect would have on first responders.
"The pre-existing condition protections that are embedded in the Affordable Care Act would have the most direct effect on the heroes and heroines that have been on the front lines of the pandemic in the form of first responders, that's police, firefighter, EMS, the nurses, healthcare professionals. We know that already, at least by the Guardian's count, 1,000 have perished in this pandemic here in the United States. And for essential workers, that includes all the folks that get us to where we're going and have been stocking all the shelves. Really the people that bring us the three-dimensional world, who had to work out of their homes. All of those folks and their families, which by dint of the occupational exposure of the person who's working in these professions, all are at risk of losing their health care because the COVID exposure and whatever bout they had with it becomes a pre-existing condition. While there's a kind of lionizing of this workforce, we don't hear from them directly as far as their views on what needs to be done. And many of them will tell you, particularly in the healthcare sector, that it was the American disinvestment for decades in public health that set us up for this moment where so many are dying.
And as chief leader reporter and WBAI regular, Bob Hennelly. And that's the news for Monday, October 26, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Richie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.